D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Hans-Jürgen Bartsch. Heute Government Without Trust von Russell Hardin. Einleuchtend klingt die Behauptung, wonach eine demokratische Staatsführung von einem gewissen Maß an Vertrauen abhängig ist. Inwieweit oder in welchem Umfang die Bürger ihren Politikern ein solches entgegenbringen, ist eine ganz andere Frage. Eine auch für unsere Forscher, die auf diesem Sendeplatz ja ständig zu Wort kommen. Viele Theoretiker schließen dabei von sozialem Vertrauen automatisch auf politisches Vertrauen. Nicht alle teilen allerdings diesen Schluss. Der amerikanische Politikwissenschaftler Russell Hardin gehört zu denen, die diese automatische Übertragung entschieden ablehnen. Vertrauensverhältnisse zwischen Einzelnen lassen sich, so meint er, nicht so ohne weiteres auf politische Institutionen anwenden. Man könne vielmehr davon ausgehen, dass Individuen zwar einzelnen Vertretern oder einer recht kleinen Regierungsbehörde vertrauen können, nicht jedoch einer kompletten Regierung an sich. Nur eine kleine Minderheit von etwa 5% der Bevölkerung verfüge überhaupt über die notwendigen Informationen, um die Vertrauensfrage für sich beantworten zu können. Behauptungen, Regierungen benötigten das Vertrauen der Bürger, um zu funktionieren, treffen seiner Meinung nach nicht zu. Russell Hardin lehrt seit 1993 Politikwissenschaft an der New Yorker Universität. Zu seinen Hauptinteressen zählen Rational Choice, kollektives Handeln sowie moralische und politische Philosophie. Er hat zahlreiche Arbeiten veröffentlicht zum Vertrauen, zuletzt die Bücher Trust and Trustworthiness und Trust. Den Vortrag hat Russell Hardin am 4. November 2011 auf der Tagung On Trust des Einstein-Forums in Potsdam gehalten.
So it is a tremendous pleasure to be here, my second time in Potsdam and in this case also meeting a wonderful collection of people, most of whom I had not known before. So it's a delight to be with you guys. And I'll be glad to hear from you after I get through presenting my arguments here. I'm going to talk about an issue that has come up historically a long time ago, not just as part of the contemporary efflorescence of work on trust. And that issue is how well the state or the government can do if the citizens don't trust it. How well can it do if the citizens don't, in some sense, do more than merely acquiesce in what it wants them to do. And the number of people who have claimed that government cannot work without public trust is staggering in some of the best names in social theory, beginning with people like Durkheim and later Talcott Parsons and Alman and Verba, the political scientists and so on, all of whom think that without trust on the part of the population, cooperation to some extent, the government can't work. All you have to do is look to see that it's false. Government seems to work in a lot of places where it surely does not have very much trust from the population. So something else is going on, and I'm not going to give an answer to what that is, but I'm going to try to make some sense of the general arguments about trust. To begin, I'm going to stipulate the way to think of trust, which is that I trust you means I think you will be trustworthy with respect to whatever is at stake. That doesn't mean you'll be trustworthy all the time or with respect to other things or even with respect to my associates or whatever. It just means that in a particular context in which I want you to, in some way, rely on me, then you will want me to be trustworthy. So trustworthiness is, in fact, the definitive characteristic of something in the background that's going on that makes trust sensible. It would not be sensible for me to say I trust you or to think even for a minute that I trust you if I think you're utterly untrustworthy. So the two go together. That's sometimes argued, as I have just done it, but it's not a universal view. In fact, when I was running a huge trust project in New York, mostly, and around the world, the first meeting was in the law school at New York University, and we generated people's definitions of trust. There were 9 clearly distinct definitions, some of which I thought were ridiculous, but that's okay. There were people who thought they were the correct explanation of what's going on. And the striking feature of those 9 was that, except for a couple of them, they wouldn't be part of explanations. They were about the Platonic definition of trust rather than about what difference it would make if we did trust according to one of the criteria or the criteria of these different theories. So if you want to give an explanation of things, you're going to have to go more or less toward looking at how the trust that you see in some relationship, not necessarily your own, will affect further actions and further beliefs of the parties involved. Well, in that mode, there are 3 standard theories of trust. They're not definitions, they're theories. And they stand probably for definitions, but the theory is the most important part of them. First, I think I trust you in some context with respect to some set of things. It just means to say, I judge you to be trustworthy toward me in that context. And why would I think you're trustworthy toward me? Well, there are 3 possible reasons. I think you're committed yourself to maintaining a trustworthy character. And in fact, in this meeting at the law school, the most common statement of what's going on with trust is that one, that we are somehow committed morally or in character to being trustworthy. Second, I think you have a strong moral commitment to fulfilling trust that you have taken on in some sense. Now, that's an important thing, that you have taken it on. It's not merely that you're going to be trustworthy with respect to what I would like for you to do. You're going to be trustworthy with respect to what you, in some sense, have agreed to do or implied you would do or whatever. So it's a very particular notion of commitment in that case. And the third, and the one that I think is, in fact, most important for us in the social sciences, is I think you have good reason to want to maintain good relations with me in particular, or relevant others, those whose actions are going to build on the reputational effects of my action, for example. So those 3 theories, or those 3 ways envisioning trust, are going to lie behind most of what actually happens in the literature. I'm going to stick with the 3rd one, and you could expand and include other things, or you could expand and include the other 2 here, so you wouldn't need merely to be stuck with the 3rd one, but I think the 3rd one for social science context, for political context, and so forth, is the one that cuts most of the action. We're going to begin with the person who probably more than anybody else in political theory historically ran against this Durkheim-Parsons et al. Theory that we should trust the government and that will make the government possible. And the major figure against that view is James Madison. In lots of writings before the Convention for the American Constitution and in writings after that, although he slipped later in life and began to be a politician like any other, but for a long while, in fact, he was a major theorist. And his view was, in fact, you ought to distrust government. So it's just utterly counter to the Durkheim et al. Thesis that we should trust government, that will make government possible. Madison thinks we ought to deliberately distrust government. In fact, he thinks it's not even a matter of deliberateness of our deciding or whatever. He thinks it just is the case that we will distrust government for the simple reason that government has lots of resources and lots of conflicting interests represented within it. And so it's going to run over some of us when it does something that benefits some other group of us. And so we should all be in a position of distrusting the government. There is an interesting body of survey research on trust that started in the 60s a little bit and then especially blossomed in the 70s and later that says that the people in the United States who could even claim to know enough to judge the competence or the trustworthiness or any of those things of the government is less than 5% of the electorate. Most people know almost nothing about the government. There's some standard responses to that. For example, in an election year when the recognition of somebody ought to come most readily, voters don't even know the names of the people they're going to be voting for. They don't know the names of the people who are running for Congress or the Senate when there is a candidate from the Senate. So that's a kind of prima facie evidence that people are ignorant in politics. We would be interested to know much more than that. We'd wonder about particular issues, should the U.S. be involved in Iraq and all that kind of stuff. And that's more important to us if we're trying to understand these issues. So the general argument is that you can't basically trust government because you don't know enough to trust government. In fact, government probably couldn't do anything that would give you the evidence that you could trust it. Now, ironically, there's an asymmetry in this because you can distrust government. So I can trust you individually and I can distrust you individually. At the institutional level, we can not trust an institution. That doesn't mean we necessarily do distrust it, but we can distrust it and we can know that that's what's going on. So that was Madison's plea. The people who are the central figures in political philosophy on the ground in the last several hundred years in the Anglo-Saxon world were John Locke, David Hume, Adam Smith, and James Madison. Madison being the only one who actually gets to the point of trying to design the institutions. Locke designed an institution. He wrote a constitution for the Carolinas. It has to be one of the dumbest constitutions ever written. It requires that there never be any change in anything in that constitution, for example. That's just so writing 300 years ago, he should have known enough about all of this stuff to get the one right possible constitution. That's implausible. So essentially, in the contemporary debate, here's a really nice statement by Geraint Parry of what's going on here. He says, political trust is an epiphenomenon of social trust, which is trust between individuals. Where consensus is lacking, social trust and consequently political trust will be lacking, and the political system will be less stable. Whether it'll be less or more stable, I think we're in a very poor position to say, but it's just not something to take for granted, as Parry does, that in fact less trust is going to make us more unstable. Almond and Verba, probably the most famous study of political attitudes across five Western countries, is the work of Almond and Verba, and they insist that belief in the benignity of one's fellow citizens is directly related to one's propensity to join with others in political activity. It is important for you and me that we have good relations with each other for us to then go on to, in some sense, extrapolate relations to government. And in fact, they argue, Almond and Verba and Parry too, that there's a kind of spillover effect. So if we have trust in this set of social relationships that we have, then we will have trust in other things as well, trust in politicians and so forth. But the spilling over of trust is probably an overstated claim. It's certainly, at least so far, in the literature is an overstated claim because there are not studies that measure that to show that it is true that there is strong spilling over of one side's vision to another side. Yesterday, the issue came up whether you could be able to trust an institution when the institution, in some sense, is working against you, or whether you could, with an untrustworthy state, have good relationships with other people. The Soviet Union gives us actually examples on both sides of that. So if you were part of Samizdat, the underground writing, You probably knew lots of people whom you personally trusted. If you couldn't have trusted them, you would have avoided them because they could get you in desperate trouble if you were found out to be one of the contributors to this literature. On the other side is this huge population of people who revere Stalin as a demigod. He's just fantastic. And you'd have to try to figure that out from knowing people on the ground, and it's really hard to do. That movie, Burnt by the Sun, is a kind of panoply of the range from people who knowingly, rightly distrust that guy and people who virtually worship him, thinking that he's good. Well, that's a world that we might have wound up in, and the Soviet Union did wind up in it for a while. So back to that claim, the research is a scholar at the University of California, Irvine, the study of all of the people out there, what they do know about the government, people who are going to vote, people mostly who are going to vote. And in fact, that's one of the things that the person doing this work, Russell Neumann, wanted to find. He wanted to find what people who are participating, at least at the level of voting, to find out their view. People aren't even giving us any clue about that. Then it doesn't matter so much whether we analyze them. So the ones we want are those who are politically active, and it's from his studies that the conclusion is reached that only about 5% of these people are in a position to pass judgment on or to evaluate the government. Orlando Patterson, the sociologist at Harvard who works on these issues, says that that small group of 5% is probably the group of people who make the government work at all. So there is this tiny crowd of people, a kind of an elitist crowd too, except that you get into it on your own effort. It's not something that you're elected to. You get into this crowd by putting the effort into understanding what's going on with the government. And so Orlando Patterson says this small group accounts for the vibrancy and integrity of the democratic system in America. If that's so, then we're probably in trouble, but it's not as bad trouble as some of us might have thought in recent years. So instead of our having a government that's unfair and elitist, we have a government that is somehow the product of people who've self-selected themselves to know about the government. I had looked forward to having Piotr Stomka here to talk about some of his work on Poland and the euphoria after 1989, falling into total distress for a brief period and then coming around to a more reasonable position at the end, because he has a real example in which there are real data showing what the attitudes are on all of these things. Robert Dahl, the great democratic theorist in the United States, says that if we're trying to understand these issues, it's probably important to recognize that hegemony, somebody who gets in anything like full control, especially autocratic hegemony, as in the Soviet Union, favors extreme distrust. I think actually that's probably false, that in fact the opposite will at least as often be true, that extreme distrust brings about hegemonic control or contributes to it. So what we have is people like Madison, but also others from an earlier time, Hume and Smith and so forth, who are very skeptical of really strong commitments to the quality of the government and so forth, or tending to criticize it deeply about many things and about, in particular, its effort to reach people and to bring them into the society, to bring them into the governmental process and so forth. And along comes, much later than these people, Anthony Downs and a large literature saying that in actual fact, as far as you are concerned, it's more rational for you not to know that stuff. It isn't worth knowing. You're going to have very little impact on it. Maybe the 5% who put a lot of effort into knowing it are in fact going to have some payoff from that. They're going to get jobs or contracts or whatever, so that it's not actually a beneficial thing to be in there. And so Dahl's probably an overstatement. However, if you think about Hume's position or James Madison's, the downside of misplaced trust at a point that was made several times yesterday, is disastrous. If I trust you when you're utterly untrustworthy, then I can suffer a great loss as a result of it. So that's a symmetry that's probably not likely to be there in general in interpersonal relations, where we know a lot about each other, so that we couldn't, in fact, have misplaced trust at a very high level. So it's, in fact, probably something that will happen in these contexts of Durkheim et al., in which the increased trust or the misplaced trust is the trust you and I have in the government, or we might have. We're probably going into an era, or are already in an era, in which that's less true than it was, say, 30 years ago, and less true still than it was in the time when Alman and Verba were writing and showing, in fact, that people had a strong commitment to it. So what we have now is lots of people, the Tea Party and others, who distrust government deeply. Some of them distrust government, want to be the government, and presumably would be eminently distrusted or untrustworthy if they became the government, just as anybody else has been in their view. So there probably is no way around this issue of untrustworthiness of the government. We're going to all, in fact, see it that way. So people like Hume have a somewhat skeptical view of what goes on in politics, think that you and I don't, in fact, get strongly committed. Some people do. Most of us do not. And we go along with the government in the sense, very weak sense, that we acquiesce in what it wants to do. We don't influence what it wants to do. We don't oppose what it wants to do. We might oppose it in talking with our neighbors, but we don't do much about it at the level of the government itself. So we just acquiesce. And in fact, in the Federalist Papers, the letters written by various people, Brutus, Madison, and several others, made that statement that all the government wants, once this Constitution is put in place, is for you and me, the citizens, to acquiesce, to do whatever it says to do. So for Hume, the whole edifice of government is essentially a convention. It's a coordination on the part of lots of people, some of whom will come out losers in the process, and many of which will, of whom will come out winners in the process. But basically, apart from those who might be participants in any governmental project we create, most of us will just go along by acquiescing in whatever it is the government does. And if we have allegiance to the government, it will be something like that. So Hume is against, really clearly against, although he doesn't name them. In fact, notoriously, people writing at that time in history never name anybody that they're going to criticize or whatever. But Hobbes actually has a really wonderful argument for why it's the right policy to follow. It looks like he's tricked up views of other people and passed them off as his own. I think actually it would have helped a lot if sometimes we had known just exactly what they were opposed to. But Hume is the counter to the Durkheim, Parsons et al. Claim that somehow in our society we have a normative consensus. We have shared values on things. We do have some shared values, not across 300 million people, but we're not all individually defined in our values, but we're nothing like what Durkheim, Parsons et al. Want, who in fact insists that we be really strongly committed to the same set of values, and that if we're not, then we're in trouble and something should be done by the government to try to change that.
Sie verfolgen heute auf D-Radio Wissen den Vortrag des Politikwissenschaftlers Russell Hardin und sein Thema Government Without Trust. Nach einer kurzen Pause geht's in seinem Vortrag an dieser Stelle weiter.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
In addition to that funny flaw in reasoning that afflicts many people, not just Parsons et al., but afflicts many people, there is another fallacious bit of argument that comes up all the time in political philosophy, political theory, the explanation of real politics, deliberative democracy, all of those things, which is the fallacy of composition. The fallacy of composition is a logical error in which you assume that the elements that make up some joint project or joint thing have the same characteristics as that joint thing, and vice versa, that of a joint thing, the characteristics will be those of the members of the joint thing. And, of course, that need not be true. It could be true. So, for example, if you've got a can of paint, the bits of it are green and the whole of it is green in some way, that is probably not a fallacious argument. But the argument in political theory is disastrous. And in fact, the argument of Durkheim et al. Irritated many economists for a long time, more than 100 years back. And in 1965, Mansur Olson put out a book on what he calls the logic of collective action. Economists criticize him for having a whole book on that. It could have been done in a short article because the argument is so clear. It's just about what happens or what the incentives would be when many of us try to join together in accomplishing some project and will probably succeed under certain circumstances and not under others. And the circumstances in which we are most likely to succeed are when the numbers are very small, especially just two of us. And the context in which we're less likely to succeed are when, in fact, the costs of doing something are moderately high to you, the individual, but way below the benefit you would get if all of us succeeded in making our contribution to those costs. And so the end result is we don't do that if we're a large group, and therefore we, in fact, miss out on things that we could have got. We could have got them collectively. But imagine the same phenomenon or the same fallacy in the context of trust. In essence, we could say that we, this group, trust that other group in some way, or we, the individuals of this group, trust another group. So we somehow compose the other group into a homogeneous thing. It's a bunch of people who are now influenced by us. And all of them come to the same conclusion. All of them, therefore, are, as far as we're concerned, essentially trustworthy. They're going to do what it would take for us to trust them. Well, I mentioned Madison's views. He is, in fact, the author of what you could call liberal distrust. So he's a liberal in the English 19th century, early 19th century sense, not in the American polluted sense from any time, any period of history. Liberals are people who, in fact, respect each other and a few other things, but basically they are people who let you lead your life while you let them lead their life. And there used to be a strong move toward social libertarianism in the United States. And it is an interesting fact, the election of 1952 was probably the last election in the United States in which one of the two parties put up as its candidate a social libertarian, or rather within one of the parties, the selection process included looking at a social libertarian. That was Robert Taft, who died shortly after the election, so he could not have done the kinds of things he was talking about. But then there was Eisenhower, and on the Democratic side, there's Adlai Stevenson. They are not social libertarians. And the irony is that, in fact, social libertarians would, in fact, be in the United States at the moment a really positive contribution to things, because they would undercut all of the things that, to some extent, Philip was talking about yesterday. Knowledge that they lack, not merely that they lack because they didn't study enough, but they aggressively lack it. They don't want to know it, and they nevertheless want to vote on what's to be done about the things that they deliberately refuse to know. And so there we would have, essentially in the Madisonian view, the beginnings of political and economic liberalism based, founded on distrust. And distrust is therefore, in that vision, a really good thing. In fact, it's probably one of the most positive, even though it's a negative-sounding word, it's probably one of the most positive elements in social theory and social life in the West in the period from, say, pre-Locke to now, or from even Hobbes. Hobbes you could think of as a proto liberal in the sense that he focuses exclusively on individuals. There are no group-level fallacy of composition arguments in Hobbes. It's all arguments about individuals. Well, that's the first move toward liberalism, although it's a little odd and it grates on your nerves a bit to think of Hobbes as a liberal. So why did American constitutionalists, and in particular, of course, Madison, want us to focus so clearly on trust? Why are they so bothered by it? They want to constrain the government because in the previous 200 or 300 years in England, and even worse in the colonies, the central government had been ridiculously abusive, sometimes for no good reason, sometimes in order to reward somebody else and so forth. So that you'll read on marmalade still today, it's by patent of the queen or the king or whatever. Marmalade should somehow be restricted in its possible manufacturers and sellers, just in order to benefit somebody in the larger society. Well, the range of things is much greater than that. And so Madison and company write the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to address those things. Those things are, in fact, laid out in the Bill of Rights. School kids who today read that stuff can't figure out for a minute what's going on. Well, you'd have to know the history of what the abuses had been to see that what's going on is that we are reacting in 1787 against what the king had done during recent uprisings in England. So that history lies behind, and you could get rid of it. In fact, in constitutions being written in much of the world today, often they do get rid of some of that stuff, although many of those nations have had a similar history, and so they can't get away with it. I mean, they can't do away with it. So again, the typical citizen can't know enough to actually judge government, so can't know enough to in fact be in a position to trust government if there were any way to explain trust in that large number context. My trusting an institution rather than my trusting you, a person who works in the institution. Well, one of the funny things that we find in studies, in fact, Russell Neumann found them in these surveys he was doing, one of the funny things we find is that people distrust government but think their representative is really good. And that's across the board. So huge numbers of people think that the agent of government whom they will most likely interact with in a meaningful way is a perfectly trustworthy person. Then why is the government in the end not trustworthy? And they don't have an explanation of that. In fact, I think so far nobody has a good explanation of that. That and several other anomalous views that people have. People who are relatively poor support there being inheritance, tax-free inheritance and so forth. It's not to their benefit, but they support that very strongly. And this other thing they support very strongly. So we can't do very much to overcome the power relationship that we're part of with government, and that makes us, if we're at least a little bit alert to what might happen, makes us distrust this government. And so the end result is that, in fact, we're going to see a world that's not all that different from the vision that the Federalist Papers, Madison and others took, or that, in fact, Hume takes, or Adam Smith. Smith is sometimes much too positive, but Hume is relatively skeptical on these things. So there have been two wonderful periods, probably more, and maybe there's beginning to be another one now, two wonderful periods when one of the resolutions of all of these problems that was brought up several times yesterday might have worked. And that resolution is deliberative democracy. I think deliberative democracy basically has not worked where it has been in some sense put to trial, and so deliberative democracy, unless redesigned, is probably not going to help us in this context. But the way it worked in the U.S. in 1787, 88, 89, and the way it worked in Eastern Europe in 1989, and the way perhaps it works now in the Arab Spring, is that huge numbers of people became daily interested in and read about and participated in politics. It is really hard to imagine. In fact, there should be a nice study of that. It's hard to imagine just how lush political activity was in the U.S. constitutional or the East European freedom movements, when people are in fact given reason to think about those issues. Well, it's clear that couldn't go on forever, so if that's what deliberative democracy takes, it can't be done. So we're not going to have 1787 kind of engagement today unless something crucial happens, and we'd rather something crucial not happen. So in fact, if government goes well, it's not going to go in the deliberative way. One of the leading people in the deliberative democracy movement has been Amy Gutman. And a couple of years ago, at the political science meetings, she bumped into a crowd at a table of people who worked on that, and she said, "It's over." And they said, "What's over?" And she said, "There will not be a deliberative democracy." And then she said, "Here's what happened," of course, and they all knew, so she didn't have to spell that out. The so-called town meetings across the country broke down into screaming sessions, and they probably did not involve the least bit of sharing of information except about how ugly your fellow citizen is. And so there is just no value to be gained from doing those things. Probably this year there has been some, and maybe before the election of 2012, there will be more of that kind of thing that is in fact constructive rather than destructive. But I think Amy was right, basically, for the time being. What went on in these town meetings, when members of Congress would go to their home district and announce a public meeting in a nice venue, and people would come and they would ask the congressperson about various pieces of legislation, and the congressperson would engage in conversation, and the conversation would break down very quickly. There were some of them in which in less than 10 minutes there was not another word exchanged that would have been beneficial. It's all just screaming back and forth. And so some of the members of Congress who participated in those things said they will never do it again. And you could understand why. Actually, it made things worse. It didn't make things better. But we may find a way to, in fact, somehow handle that and to have what we would like to call deliberative democracy then. But trying to go back to doing it in that, here's a venue, please come, we'll talk, way is not going to be adequate to it, to the task. And it's not clear then, therefore, what deliberative democracy could be if it can't be that kind of thing. So we need to think more about that and to try to figure it out in a way that would be constructive and help us have greater democracy in our societies. So what residue is left of the huge political debates in the United States of 1787 and so on, or for that matter in Europe, in Eastern Europe during the 1989 events? Probably in the U.S. the thing that lingers is the aura of distrust in government. Not that it was somehow stated over and over thereafter, but that it lurks in the background and it's a little bit hard to get away without recognizing it. It has potentially harmful effects on what we're going to do hereafter, unless it's not true that distrust of government is a bad thing. If it's true that it's a bad thing, then it's too bad, all these things. But if in fact it's okay that we have distrust in government, that it works just as well, then it doesn't matter that we have these events. Anthony King, who's an American or Canadian, I think, living in England, supposes that distrust of government is a peculiarly American phenomenon. I don't actually know, so I would be interested to hear from those who are from other societies whether there is something vaguely like the American phenomenon. Now, you might expect that the nations that were under autocracies of one kind or another, Nazi, communist, or whatever, those nations, once they have got free of that, would in fact be relatively positive and like government as they then begin to know it. So they probably are okay, but the nations like Sweden, England, the United States may be in a genuine downhill period in which distrust and so forth is destructive. And it may continue for a long time. King is almost certain that it just wasn't an issue in England until very recently, and it's sort of an imported issue from the North Americans across the ocean. John Tierney is a political commentator in the United States who writes very well and therefore is able to somehow enlighten people about some of these extremely difficult issues, says, in response to the movement under the second Bush presidency to create democracy in various places around the world, such as Iraq. So Tierney says, how did so many conservatives who normally don't trust their government to run a public school down the street come to believe that federal bureaucrats could transform an entire nation in the alien culture of the Middle East? It's really hard to imagine that those two things go together in the person of conservatives on these kinds of issues. But they did go together for a brief time, at least. So is democracy perhaps in decline? Is that the background condition that we're looking at when we're talking about trust? And what happens in these town meetings and so on. I think probably that's worth considering, I suspect, but I don't like that kind of sort of pit of the stomach reasoning. I suspect that democracy is in decline. It's a little hard to imagine what the next phase will be. Democracy has, of course, moved through many stages from Athens to other kinds of polities that were larger, and it became finally too large. The polities became too large, and then it became representative rather than direct democracy, and so on. So that it has been a really malleable form of government that could be reconstructed to handle quite different changes in the societies that it governed. It's not clear what the next stage would be. In fact, in the time of this other series, some of the things that happened would have been surprising. Or if we look back at them now and read that these did happen, we can be surprised. So, for example, there was a brief period when the way to elect people was by lot. And that was in some fairly successful societies. And it worked reasonably well for the simple reason, probably, and of course, these are societies that are largely class-based, aristocratic people are part of the ones who would be in the government and the other part of the population would not be. But apart from that constraint on it, it looks like a nice experiment. But it's hard to imagine, given what happened in those town meetings, that you'd get anything vaguely approaching decent or competent government if you drew its membership by lot. We may actually be going through a redefinition of democratic politics and participation. Just what does participation mean? How does it work? How does it work to change you, the participant, and how does it work to change, in some sense, the system or policies that the system is making or that other people are making through the system? So we would like to know all of those things, and we probably are not going to be able to know some of them until we're looking retrospectively at what did happen instead of trying to figure out what is built into the system as it stands right now. So let's go back for just a minute to the social libertarian change in the United States. One of the things that has happened in the U.S., maybe in other countries too, is that the nature of the citizen has changed. The voters themselves are different from what they were before. A social libertarian had a guaranteed crowd of voters in the not-too-distant past. In fact, Barry Goldwater became a libertarian candidate for president. We now have another one who's trying to get the Republican nomination for what that might be worth, and then he would be a social libertarian. But he actually isn't a social libertarian. He wants to control issues that are part of the social agenda. So for some reason, he's able to claim that he's a libertarian, and it's mostly about economic things, not about social things. So the people like Barry Goldwater, like Robert Taft, and like a much earlier generation of American political leaders, they were all, in fact, genuinely social libertarians who might have difficulty now and then with a category or whatever, but mainly they were coherent and consistent in their views. And probably the most important single person on the other side for a long time, and in some sense a kind of clown of that movement, is the preacher who preached against the study of evolution or the teaching of evolution in the schools in Tennessee in the 1920s. And he, William Jennings Bryan, was the prosecutor in that case brought in from the outside. And of course, for him, it was a case of how the Bible is to be treated. And the fact that the Constitution had ruled such questions out as part of political process in the United States seems not to have bothered Brian, and he was willing to go ahead and try to, in fact, make those kinds of changes. So this change in politics from Goldwater, who was vilified when he was actually running for office, to Bush is a really steep downhill change. Goldwater was radically the better of the two, at least on this issue, on the social libertarian issue. And if we were to look at citizens and the changes in citizens, one of the things we would see is greater fractionating of the citizens. So there are many, many different kinds of things going on. It's much harder to pull citizens together to vote as a block, and so the world is just a very different place for politicians and for analysts. I'm on the side of the analysts, and it's really a mess out there. So I would like to be able to straighten some of that out. Well, let's turn now to focusing on politics itself. There was a document issued by the American Medical Association around 1910 called the Flexner Report. And the Flexner Report, this collection of doctors, surveyed medical education, and the report was to be about medical education. And what they discovered was that as of about 1900, it became the case that if you were ill and you went to a doctor, you're likely to at least get out of there as well off as you were when you went in. Whereas before, it would have done you harm to go to a doctor. And after 1900, it probably began again to do you harm. I mean, to be good for you to go to a doctor. And I think that may actually be the nature of party politics at the moment. The economic policy, at least, has some of that character, unless it's being used in a way that's dishonest, as it is in the U.S. often. But it's one of those things on which there is agreement, and the agreement is sensibly based in the science of the policy making and so forth. Okay.
Government Without Trust von Russell Hardin war diesmal unser Thema. Gehalten hat er den Vortrag am 4. November dieses Jahres auf der internationalen Tagung unter dem Titel On Trust im Einstein Forum Potsdam.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.